everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me for another opportunity to have an in-depth conversation with the kinds of topics that are really helping us to expand our awareness, expand our sense of self, and be able to really be empowered with the kind of knowledge that makes a true difference in our lives. And as always, thank you for joining me today, and thank you for being part of this enlightening conversation that happens every week on my show. So let me just ask you, how many of you listening here would really like a more productive, creative, healthy, and peaceful life? Sounds interesting? Sounds impossible? Or maybe it's really inspiring you to perk up and listen. Well, whatever your response was to that statement, I want you all to pay attention, because today we are going to be learning the keys for a more productive, creative, healthy, and peaceful life with Dr. Ron Siegel. So just to let me take a minute and introduce Dr. Siegel to you. Dr. Ron Siegel is an assistant professor of psychology part-time at Harvard Medical School, where he has taught for over 30 years. He is a longtime student of mindfulness meditation and serves on the board of directors and faculty at the Institute for Meditation and Psychotherapy. He teaches internationally about the application of mindfulness practice in psychotherapy and other fields, and maintains a private clinical practice in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Dr. Siegel is co-author of the Self-Treatment Guide, BackSense, a Revolutionary Approach to Halting the Cycle of Chronic Back Pain, which integrates Western and Eastern approaches for treating chronic back pain, co-editor of the critically acclaimed text, Mindfulness and Psychotherapy, the second edition, author of a book for general audiences, The Mindfulness Solution, Everyday Practices for Everyday Problems, co-editor of Wisdom and Compassion in Psychotherapy, Deepening Mindfulness in Clinical Practice, with a foreword by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and co-author of the recently released Sitting Together, Essential Skills for Mindfulness-Based Psychotherapy. He is also a regular contributor to other professional publications, and is co-author of the annual Harvard Medical School Conference on Meditation and Psychotherapy. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Ron Siegel to the show. Hello, Ron.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, and thank you for the wonderful work you have been doing over many, many years in introducing the tool of mindfulness to so many people around the world. I'm sure it's been a great delight for you to be able to take this mindfulness practice and make a difference in so many people's lives.
Oh, it really has been an exciting adventure, and this is something that my own interest in this dates back to when I was in high school. That's when I first started doing some mindfulness meditation practice, and it predated my training as a psychologist. So it has infused my life experience from way back, and it's been really heartening to see this evolution and interest in this, especially over the last 15 or 20 years, where this has gone from being something that a very narrow section of the population was interested in, into being now very mainstream. I don't know if you saw, it was on the cover of Time magazine, and just recently Anderson Cooper did a weekend mindfulness meditation retreat and did a piece on 60 Minutes about his experience doing this, that so many more folks throughout the whole society are now discovering that mindfulness practices are really useful for leading a happier and fuller life.
You know, I didn't watch that segment with Anderson Cooper, so maybe it would be a good way to introduce this topic by sharing what his experience was. I mean, he's a hardcore anchorman journalist. What happened to him when he did a mindfulness course?
Well, he was really impressed by the way in which it changed his feeling states, as well as how his mind was working. And he said, this is it. I'm going to build this into my life from here on forward, because it feels so much better.
Yeah.
And you know, basically what happens to folks when they take up these practices is they start to notice that in general they feel less stressed. And even more importantly, it's not feeling less stressed in the sense of being kind of sedated or just cooled out or calmed in the way that one might if one takes a tranquilizer. But at the same time as feeling less stressed, people feel much more sensitized to the everyday moments of their lives. So that the even though it's a cliche that it's a good idea to smell the roses and, notice the moment-to-moment little things in our lives, and that's where we get fulfillment. That really is where we get fulfillment, and there's tremendous data now showing that to the extent to which we can train our minds to be in the present, we wind up not only being more effective in the world, but happier and having a richer experience. And mindfulness practices are really about systematically training the brain and training the mind to show up for our lives, to actually be present moment to moment in our experience.
I think a good place to begin in this conversation so people can understand what mindfulness really is offering them is to define what mindfulness meditation is. And I have to say that when I often talk to my patients about meditating, I so frequently hear the response, oh, look, I can't do that. I can't quiet my mind. You know, so people have all sorts of pictures about what meditation is, what it requires, what kind of person is capable of doing it. And I think we need to start at the very beginning to dispel many of these myths so people really are open and receptive to the tools that will make such a difference in the quality of their lives.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And let me start by talking about what mindfulness is and then what mindfulness meditation is, because they're a little bit different. Mindfulness is really simply an attitude toward our experience, toward whatever's happening in this particular moment. And it's an attitude that includes being aware of what's happening right now in this moment and being able to accept what's happening in this moment. So rather than mounting a kind of aversion response and saying, oh, I don't like this, I don't like that, I want this to be different, I want that to be different, it's about being with, noticing, feeling what's happening right now and working to accept what's happening right now. So that's mindfulness. It's an attitude toward experience. Now, to cultivate that attitude toward experience, we do mindfulness practices. And you could think of this as through an analogy with physical fitness. Physical fitness is strength, endurance, and flexibility. But to cultivate physical fitness, well, we do various exercises. We might go to the gym or go jogging or bike riding or whatever. And in the same way, mindfulness is this attitude toward experience. And to cultivate it, we do mindfulness exercises. And many of those exercises are forms of meditation practice. Because meditation practices often come from Eastern cultures, a lot of us in the West are a little bit unfamiliar with them, and we have a number of misconceptions. And some of those misconceptions are exactly the things that you just began discussing. For example, many, many people think, oh, well, to do meditation correctly, I have to make my mind a complete blank. There's a story that Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's done a lot to bring mindfulness meditation practices into medicine, likes to tell. And he's leading a retreat, and there's a fellow brings him a little comic, a Bazooka Joe comic, the kind that comes in bubblegum. And in the comic, there's Bazooka Joe sitting in his cross-legged, full lotus meditation posture, and he's got his sidekick, Mort, next to him. And Joe is saying, since I've discovered meditation, my mind is a complete blank. And Mort says, gee, Joe, I thought you were born that way. You know, so this is not about losing our capacity for higher cortical processing. It's not about losing our capacity to think, to have judgment, to remember the past, or to plan the future. But it is about beginning to have some flexibility about whether we're just living in our thought stream, just living in the sort of constant torrent or narrative of words that are passing through our heads, or whether we're also able to taste our food, notice the sensations of our body moving through space, see the sky, smell the roses, etc. It's really not about getting the thought stream to stop, because it doesn't tend to stop, except occasionally for brief periods when people do a lot of intensive retreat practice. But for most of us meditating most of the time, the mind's not going to become a blank. It's going to be filled with all sorts of thoughts and images and feelings, a whole kaleidoscope of experience. And we're not trying to make it stop. But what we are trying to do is begin to be with it without resisting it, and to notice what the mind is doing when the mind is doing what it does. So to actually not just be living in thoughts of constantly planning the future and planning the future, or remembering the past, but to actually have a sense of being present as we're doing things. You know, another big misconception is that it's supposed to get rid of emotions. Because after all, most people don't start up a meditation practice, or for that matter, begin a yoga practice, or start going to church, or even start going to the gym regularly when they've just won the lottery, fallen in love, and gotten a promotion, right? People tend to turn to these practices when they're dissatisfied in some way in their life, and that often means when we've been disappointed in some sense. And the fantasy is, oh, good, I'll do this, and all the painful feelings will go away. And some people say, I don't want to do meditation because, I don't want to kill off my feelings. Well, that's not what happens. The painful feelings don't go away. In fact, we feel them more vividly. We actually feel our sadness more deeply. We feel our anger more vividly. We might feel our longings more vividly. But by the same token, we also feel our joy more vividly. We feel our love more vividly. We feel our sense of engagement or wonder more vividly. Everything becomes more alive. The difference is between that and our normal waking consciousness is, because mindfulness practice is awareness of present experience with acceptance, rather than fighting the painful states, we learn to develop the capacity to feel the painful states, not resist them. And what we discover when we do that is they move through us much more rapidly. When we get stuck in a negative state of mind, it's almost invariably because we're resisting some kind of painful feeling and trying to stop it or block it. So what we find when we do the meditation practice and is that where thoughts are continuing to come, but they come and go a little bit more like clouds passing through the sky. We're less, we resist them less, and we struggle with them less. And feelings come and go also like the clouds passing through the sky. And the net result is feeling much less stressed, much more at peace, and much more engaged in the world. But you don't have to have some kind of still and tranquil mind in order to benefit a great deal from these practices.
And I think that's so important to emphasize. To me, this is a tool to enhance our ability to live life more more resourcefully, more aware. I did a retreat, a 10-day retreat one time, and we were sitting a lot, and we were practicing just this state of observing without judgment, just observing things more mindfully. And I, found my body getting really painfully sore, like the muscles in my back were getting tight. And as I just gave myself permission to sit there and observe that sensation, something amazing happened. That pain just disappeared. It became a sensation. It wasn't a pain that I was saying, oh, it hurts. It was such a profound experience of actually, when entering that place of non-judgment, how we can transform these pains and just have it as a sensational experience.
Absolutely. And that is such an important insight that can come from these practices. And you may find it interesting that there's now neurobiological evidence describing how that works and what's going on. I'll share a study with you. There's a wonderful study in which they took experienced meditators and novices who didn't have much experience, and they put them in a functional MRI machine, which is like an MRI, that's magnetic resonance imaging, which allows us to view the soft tissues of the body, in this case the brain. And a functional MRI machine is like a video of that. It can record what's happening in the brain over time. So they put they put people in that machine. And they administered a painful laser to their feet, to the feet, because the feet are what stick out of the MRI machine when you're in it, when your head is in it. And they did that for both groups. And what they discovered was, for the meditators, what they found was a lot of activation in a part of the brain called the insula. And the insula has many functions, but one of its principal functions is to perceive sensations in the body. So if we're attuned to what's happening in our body and we're feeling the sensations that are happening in our body, we have a lot of activation in the insula. So the meditators had a lot of activation in the insula, but did not have a lot of activation in the prefrontal cortex. Now, the prefrontal cortex is involved when we're making evaluations of what's going on, when we're thinking, I like this, I don't like this, this is good, this is bad, oh, I hope this will stop, oh, I hate this, oh, I'm afraid of this. All of those thoughts, those thoughts are occurring when there's activation in the prefrontal cortex. So the meditators had insula activation, but not a lot of prefrontal cortical activation, meaning they were feeling the sensations of the laser very vividly, but they weren't thinking about it so much, and they weren't judging it and hating it and rejecting it. The non-meditators, the novices, had much less activation in the insula, suggesting that they weren't actually feeling the sensation so well, but they had a lot of activation in the prefrontal cortex, suggesting that they were thinking a lot about it and thinking, I hate it, oh no, when's it going to stop, are they going to do it again? And then they asked both groups to rate their pain, and the meditators said, it wasn't much pain at all, it was really just kind of a sensation, exactly as you've just described happened to you with your, you know, the body discomfort during your retreat. And the non-meditator said, wow, that hurt a lot. They rated it very high on it's called the visual analog pain scale that's used to evaluate these things. So we now have laboratory data that shows that if we can train our minds and train our brains to be able to be with and accept moment-to-moment experience, even literally painful experience causes much less suffering. And we don't have a whole aversion response to it, and we're basically okay with it. And once we discovered this in the physical realm, as often happens if you meditate for a longer period of time and the body gets achy, and exactly as you described, if you can bring your attention to that in a non-judgmental, open way, notice that, oh gosh, you know, it kind of transforms, and it's a sensation. It's not even that hard to be with. When we notice that in the physical realm, then we start to notice, oh my, the same thing happens in the emotional realm. Because if we think about emotional pain is really a sensation in the body accompanied by some thought or image. So if I'm sad, and maybe everybody who's listening now could take a moment to just conjure up a little bit of a feeling of sadness and, you know, think of something that perhaps that makes you sad, and notice that, well, what's sadness? Well, it's a sensation in the body, right? It's, you know, maybe a heaviness in the heart or a feeling in the belly or maybe a tightness in the throat or a feeling in the eyes. So it's a body sensation accompanied with the thought of, you know, the sad thing or the disappointment or the loss, and maybe an image if we're sad about a loved one or some event. And that's all it is. And if we can learn to accept and ride out and be with those kinds of sensations, well, then we can tolerate a whole range of emotions, both the joyous ones and the painful ones. And we wind up discovering that we can actually kind of ride the roller coaster of life much more peacefully. Or as it's sometimes said, you know, instead of trying to get the waves to stop, the waves of good and bad fortune in life, we learn to surf. We learn to be able to ride these waves. And the same is true whether it be anger, whether it be sadness, whether it be longing, whether it be joy, whether it be love, whatever it is. So that observation that pain kind of transforms by itself when you learn to be with it and open to it and relate mindfully to it has enormous implications for living life well.
You know, I so agree. I used to be the type of person that would just, get so emotional over things and operate with a lot of negative thoughts and feel the negative emotions in my body and get carried away. They would just ruin my day, you know. And I learned when I started doing some of these practices to observe emotions rather than be my emotion, which was an amazing experience, I have to say,
yeah.
Because from so many of us, we are our emotions. They run us, right?
We're
at their beck and call. So to be able to just be in a place where I can observe that I was having an emotional response, noticing where I felt it in my body, was the tool that got me out of the pain of suffering from those emotions.
I'm sorry. It's very liberating.
It's so liberating because I did not know how to deal with all the intensity of emotions that were flowing through me on a regular basis. And, you know, it is the source of our suffering. And you can medicate, you can take drugs, you can eat, you can drink, you can do all sorts of things, but it doesn't give you the inner resources to really find that sense of peace and well-being. You have to at some point, sooner or later, hopefully, you know, start putting some of these strategies and tools into play, because that is the way out. For me,
right.
Anyway,
right.
that's why I think these conversations are so important, because we're looking for the way out of pain.
Right, and I might say it's the way through,
rather than
the way out, because there's a kind of built-in paradox here, which is if we're trying to get out of discomfort, then we're probably tensing up against it, trying to get rid of it, and that ultimately can keep us trapped. Whereas if we're allowing it to happen, and then we pass through it. Let me give you an example of this with emotions, because I think it's so important what you're saying, and give you an idea of how mindfulness practice winds up changing our relationship to emotion. Let's say I've got a friend of mine, and I've been, in my mind, really, really good to him, and he does something that seems to me really self-centered and mean to me. And I get angry. I get hurt and I get angry. And I will probably have thoughts going through my mind of, I can't believe you did that to me after all I've done for you, and other similar narratives. And in a normal state of mind, I would just keep thinking that thought, keep going, ruminating over and over about the incident. And every time I'd have the thought, I'd have another wave of anger happening in the body. And then every time there was a wave of anger happening in the body, I'd have another thought about how wrong and unfair my friend was. When we start to practice mindfulness over time, we start to see the whole thing as a little bit of an almost impersonal process. We sort of notice the body tensing up, you know, the shoulders, the neck, the getting tight with the anger, and we may notice our heart rate going up and our respiration rate going up, and we're just feeling this in the body. And then we notice the thought of, I can't believe he did that to me. But instead of just being stuck in the thought and just believing in the thought, we notice it as, oh, yeah, there's that angry thought. And there might even be the image of, you know, yelling at our friend or, you know, telling him off or something like that. But we see the whole thing as just kind of events arising in the mind and the body. And when we see it this way, and when we don't identify with or believe in, or another way to say it is take so personally the thoughts, then it's just phenomena and sensations that are happening, and we can allow them to arise and pass, and we simply don't get so hooked. And that gives us enormous flexibility. It even gives us flexibility in talking to our friend, because we can say, all right, you know, when he did that, I got really angry, you know, a lot of anger came up, but because we're not believing in the story so much, you know, we can even have a conversation and say, so, you know, where were you coming from? What was going on there? We might even be able to move it forward interpersonally.
Right. So what you're saying is, these thoughts and these interpretations, this is part of the human condition that we all have brought into our life.
Absolutely.
I think one question people have a lot, and I certainly have it, is why is it so difficult? Why is it so difficult for us to have the kinds of thoughts that make us feel good? You know, why is it that we're so prone to always be running those thoughts in our mind? I'm not good enough, and I'm not lovable enough, and you know, I can't make it, and you know, the narrative that goes on all the time for so many of us. What's that about, Ron? Why is that our prevalent state as opposed to being joyful?
Yeah, that's a great question. And evolutionary biologists and psychologists who study evolutionary biology think that this is actually hardwired. And it has a name in cognitive science called the negativity bias, which is the tendency to think about the negative. And it has good reasons why we might have evolved this. If you could imagine one of our ancestors 3.5 or 4.5 million years ago, living on the African savanna, and facing a situation that was kind of ambiguous. Let's say they're looking over at a clump of bushes, and they see a beige shape behind the bushes. And they could make one of two kinds of errors. Our ancestor could think, oh my God, it's a lion, when it's really just a beige rock. We'll call that a type one error. Or they could make the type two error and say, it's probably just a beige rock, but it's really a lion, right? Now, we could make thousands and thousands of type one errors, imagining it's a lion when it's really a beige rock, and still live to tell and still pass on our genes to our offspring. But you make one of the type two errors, think, it's probably okay, it's probably just a beige rock, and that's the end of your DNA line, right? You're not gonna live to the age of reproduction. So we could imagine that the ancient hominids living out there in the African savanna, maybe they were both types. Maybe they're the ones who had evolved more by whatever chances to think the worst. They're much more likely to have survived than the ones who thought things are probably okay. So this results in, I have a friend of mine who writes about these matters named Rick Hansen. He's a neuropsychologist, and he says our minds evolved to be like Velcro for bad experiences and Teflon for good ones. The bad things stick and the good ones pass away. And we could imagine that there might have been, you know, some happy hominids hanging around, you know, singing kumbaya, thinking good things and remembering wonderful things that had happened. But they weren't our ancestors because they statistically died before they got to reproduce. Our ancestors were the ones who were hanging around every day thinking, oh, my God, what bad things have happened in the past and how might they happen again? Including, you know, all of the hurts, all of the disappointments, all of the times we've had our hearts broken and the like. And there are hundreds and hundreds of examples of this negativity bias. Even rats have it. If you take a rat and you run it down a maze, and at the end of a given channel in that maze, you give it an electric shock, that rat, one trial learning is enough. The rat will not go down that maze again. But if you give it food when it gets pathway, it needs several trials to learn how to do that. Or we can try this little experiment right now. This will work perhaps better for your American listeners than those in other countries. But I'm going to say two words, and Dr. Selman, you can tell me what comes to your mind in response to these two words, and we'll see if it's similar to what happens to others in the audience. Here come the two words. Bill Clinton. What came to mind?
Monica Lewinsky.
Monica Lewinsky, exactly.
Did I fit into the norm?
You fit into the norm. Occasionally people will say the blue dress, but...
Isn't that interesting?
Isn't that interesting? Now,
of all the things that Bill Clinton has done.
Exactly. Now, Bill Clinton, you know, whatever your politics might be, you know, Bill Clinton was, you know, he was president during a reasonably prosperous time. And, you know, he did a number of things that most people would agree were pretty successful, right? And yet, what do we remember? We remember Monica Lewinsky. And this is an example of the negativity bias. This is why it's so easy to ruin somebody's reputation, because we'll think, oh, I can't trust that person. That person did X, Y, or Z, even though all the other times they did good things. Or if you get a job review, for example. Let's say you go in to see your boss and they give you some kind of review and feedback. They could tell you 9 ways in which you're really an ideal employee and one area which is room for improvement. What are you going to think about it at night when you're going to bed?
Yeah, that one thing.
That one thing. And, you know, I'm on the speaker circuit a bunch, so we get evaluations all the time. And, you know, I can easily get, you know, 9 people saying, great workshop. One person says, oh, I didn't like this or I didn't like that. What sticks in my mind? It's that one. So it's this is quite universal, this negativity bias, which is one of the reasons why living in the thought stream, living and believing in all of these thoughts that are passing through our minds all day sets us up for so much stress and distress, because the mind evolved to focus on the negative and to anticipate bad events and to remember bad events from the past. So our thinking apparatus, while wonderful in that it allows us to do things like invent radios, that, you know, and the internet, and you know, houses and literature and everything, all the wonderful things humans have come up with, that same thinking capacity really predisposes us to a remarkable amount of psychological suffering.
Oh, that's such an interesting thought to kind of dwell on. And maybe we should, at this point, take a break so people can kind of cogitate on that one for a moment. And when we come back, I have some questions I want to ask you. I want to ask you, as a psychologist, as a clinical psychologist, how you use your mindfulness practice in your practice. And also, I think you can share some specific mindfulness experience with us. So all that's coming on the second half of the show. Hang in there, everyone. We're talking to Dr. Ron Siegel. He is the author of Mindfulness Solution, Everyday Practices to Everyday Problems. And this is such an exciting and profound conversation, so please stay tuned, and we will be right back. Hi, everyone. Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're having a wonderful, mind-expanding conversation with Dr. Ron Siegel. He is the author of The Mindfulness Solution, Everyday Practices to Everyday Problems, and we're exploring the keys to a more productive, creative, healthy, and peaceful life. So this has been such an interesting conversation, and we were talking about this negative bias, and of course the mindfulness practices help us to be less, be more observant of those thoughts, less attached to them, and therefore a little more of a distance from those emotional intensities. I'd like to ask you how you apply this in your practice as a psychotherapist, as a clinical psychologist.
Sure. Well, first let me just say how exciting it's been to see these practices, mindfulness practices and related practices, becoming quite mainstream in clinical psychology. There's an organization called the American Association for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, which is where the folks who are developing the scientifically tested mindfulness practices present their papers each year. And now the majority of presentations now are on mindfulness and acceptance-based treatment. So this has become mainstream among those people who are trying to develop psychotherapies that have a good science base to them and that are shown to work. Now, why is that? Well, they work in a number of ways. One of them is, as we were just talking about the negativity bias, so many forms of psychological distress have to do with getting stuck in some kind of thought pattern which is self-defeating, irrational, misery-making. And that takes so many forms. It takes the form of the anxiety problems in which we're catastrophizing a lot, imagining the worst, generalizing from some small instance, you know, some bad thing happens and imagining bad things happening all the time. It certainly operates in depressive disorders where people start to develop thoughts that I'm inadequate, I'm no good, I'm morally deficient in some way, and get very, very stuck in those kinds of ruminations. And it plays a role in a lot of other difficulties as well. So one of the things that mindfulness practices help us to do is, as you were saying, to simply not take the thoughts so seriously. When you spend time doing meditation practice and watching thoughts come and go, in the same way that you might watch an itch or an ache come and go, thoughts start to become just another mental phenomena, just another object in the mind, rather than these all-important things that we identify with. And when we don't identify with them, we lighten up and we feel considerably freer. So in my own work as a clinical psychologist, one of the things that I do if a client or a patient is open to learning mindfulness practices is teach them some mindfulness practices so that they can begin to develop this kind of lighter holding of their thoughts and this greater perspective on thoughts. In the world of cognitive behavior therapy that I'm sure many of your listeners have heard of, because it's often one of the most studied and scientifically supported treatments for many, many different things. This is called developing metacognitive awareness. It's being aware of what the mind is doing in each moment that it's doing it. And that's exactly what mindfulness practices help us to do. Now, another way that they play a big role in working with psychological distress is that most psychological disorders have at their core what we call emotional or experiential avoidance. Let me give you an idea of how this works. Let's take something. It's probably clearest when it comes to problems with substances, drug abuse or alcoholism, even eating disorders this way. Many, many people drink alcohol occasionally, socially, and it's no big deal. It doesn't cause a lot of difficulty for them. But if we think of why we drink alcohol, and I ask your listeners who drink alcohol, and maybe you're a normal drinker, meaning a non-problematic drinker, why do you drink? Do you drink entirely for the taste? Most people, when they're being honest, say, well, no, actually. I drink because I like to change one state of mind into another, so that if I've had a hard day at work and or some other stressful time, and it's finally the end of the day and I get to relax, I think, well, a glass of wine with dinner would feel nice, or, you know, having a beer, or, you know, whatever a person might do. And it's because they want to shift from being more tense to being more relaxed, right? Or maybe you're going to go to a party and there are, you know, going to be some people there you don't know, or sometimes worse, some people there who you do know. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, drink might just kind of take the edge off and make me a little bit more comfortable, a little less anxious, right, going to the party. So we see, you know, most of us, when we use alcohol, we're doing it to change one state that's somewhat unpleasant into another state which is more pleasant. And if we do that occasionally, you know, there's probably no harm to that. But people who feel compelled to do that big time and feel compelled to make most of their feelings change using a substance, well, you know, those are people who have substance abuse problems, right? And we know that that can be quite damaging in a life. So it's really clear there that it's experiential or emotional avoidance, trying not to feel something painful, that's at the heart of the problem. But we see that the same thing happens even in something like an anxiety problem. Like if I get anxious before I do public speaking or before I fly in airplanes, these are things I do a lot of, but I nonetheless speak publicly and fly in airplanes, well, then I probably don't have an anxiety disorder. I'm just a little bit of a nervous guy, right? But I'm doing fine with this. But if, in order not to feel anxious, I avoid public speaking, or in order not to feel anxious, I avoid flying in the airplane, well, that's an anxiety problem. That's an anxiety problem. Because what's going to happen there is I'm going to start to constrict my life because of this. And people who have bigger problems with anxiety start to do that. They start to constrict their lives to avoid the anxiety, to try to avoid the pain. And we can see that in other kinds of problems as well. So that since so many of the difficulties we get into involve trying not to feel something which is painful, that's one reason why mindfulness practice, in which we practice awareness of present experience with acceptance, which means accepting and opening to even the unpleasant states of mind when they arise, it actually winds up freeing us from so many of these different problems. So that in my clinical work, if somebody is having difficulty with a feeling, I will very often help them to bring their attention to that feeling, and instead of scrambling and trying to make it go away, we'll start to explore it and look at exactly how it feels, exactly what's happening moment to moment in my experience, really trying to increase my patient or client's capacity to be able to feel both the pleasant and the unpleasant feelings. And this I'll do in my work, even if I never mention mindfulness meditation, never actually mention these practices. It simply infuses my understanding of what causes human suffering and what the pathways are through that suffering. So, you know, there might be a person who, for whatever reason, is turned off by or doesn't like the idea of meditating, but they can nonetheless start to change their attitude toward these difficult experiences and develop a more accepting attitude toward the full range of their emotional life.
And you know, when I was learning how to do that, it allowed me to dissipate those negative emotions that would be so intrusive in my life all the time. And just by the awareness, and this was a moment of real revelation for me, the moment that I could observe an emotion happening in my body and not be that emotion was the beginning of a total transformation in how I was living life.
Yeah, and it's very freeing, and the other thing we notice is that they don't last that long. Some cognitive scientists have estimated that an emotion, if not reinforced by a repetitive thought, so let's say the feeling of anger, if it's not reinforced by the thought of, I can't believe my friend did that to me, I can't believe he did it, lasts about 90 seconds.
Well, and like, then it's gone.
Yeah.
It's like an energy that comes and goes.
Right, it's like an itch or an ache. You know, these are transient events. They get stuck when we resist them, and they get stuck when we identify with them and start taking them on as a big personal cause.
I also notice if I'm getting activated by something, I get caught in an endless loop. I am there obsessing what that person did, what they said, how I should have, you know, and it's like I'm caught. It's like an endless loop. How do you get out of those endless loops?
Well, I find it's often very helpful to begin to turn my attention to something other than the thought stream, because the loop is a loop of thought. And if I can turn my attention instead to just the breath in the body, or the sensations of the feet on the ground as I'm walking, or the appearance of the tree in the sky right now, and begin to see the thoughts as coming and going against the backdrop of reality. And by reality, I mean moment to moment what's happening here and now. You know, the reality is there is only this moment. Everything else is either fantasies about the past that we call memories or fantasies about the future, right? But there really is only this moment. Everything else is constructed by the mind. And when we do mindfulness practice with some regularity, we start to notice that more and more, so that we notice that the thought is a thought, and we can redirect our attention, not to block the thought, but to notice that the thought exists against this backdrop of reality. And that helps it to lose some of its grip. And you know, because ultimately we can take refuge in this moment. If, you know, so many of the things that disturb us are fantasies of the past and the future. you know, even people who are in terrible, dire circumstances, you know, when an EMT is extracting somebody from an automobile wreck, the person will usually be thinking, oh my God, will I be able to walk? Will I survive? Will my loved ones be okay? Even there, they're thinking about the future. The actual pain of the moment, often people can tolerate that. And you know, we know this. I'll give you an example from where this has been studied in the laboratory. There's a test which is used by pain psychologists called the cold presser test. And it's a way that you can basically inflict pain on a laboratory subject without harming them and opening yourself up to lawsuits. And what you do is you have the person immerse their hand in a pail of ice water. And if you set that experiment up in different ways, you get very different results. If you tell a subject, let's say you have them put their hand in ice water, and you tell them that they're going to have to keep it in there for 30 seconds, and you ask them after 15 or 20 seconds to rate their pain level, they'll say, you know, it's moderate, it's kind of cold, but it's okay, because they know it's only going to last 30 seconds. If you set up the experiment identically, except vary one thing, you tell the subject, you're going to keep your hand in there for 10 minutes, and you ask them after 15 or 20 seconds to rate their pain level, they'll say, you know, it's already a 9 out of 10, and I'm not going to last 10 minutes. This is horrible. So the thought that this is going to last forever is what, or 10 minutes, is what determines how aversive or difficult it is. So when we begin to train our minds over and over to come back into the present moment, we start to see that we can bear so much more. We can tolerate such greater intensity, even of discomfort, because we're just in the. It's just a series of moments, and the fantasy of it lasting forever is just a thought. That's just a fantasy. So there's enormous, enormous value to this training of the mind to come back into the present. It tends to put difficulty into perspective, and at the same time, it allows us to savor life. It allows us. I'll give you one other little research study I think that's very relevant here. There's a fellow named Matthew Killingsworth. He was a graduate student in the lab of Dan Gilbert at Harvard. And Dan Gilbert wrote a book called Stumbling on Happiness. He's probably the world's leading scholar of how we look for happiness in all the wrong places, basically. And Killingsworth devised a smartphone application that would page people at random intervals, and he had about 2,000 subjects participate in this. And the idea was when the smartphone would page them, they had to answer three questions. What are you doing? How are you feeling? And where is your attention at the moment, at this moment that you're being paged? And what he found was, first he found that people's minds were wandering, were far from what they were doing, he said 47% of the time. I think that's a terribly low estimate, that if the people had tried some mindfulness practice, they'd say more like 97% of the time our minds are wandering. But nonetheless, he found that what predicted whether people felt happy or not or had a sense of well-being or not was not what they were doing, but was where their attention was. So that if a person was washing the dishes and was paying attention to the experience of washing the dishes, was feeling the warm, sudsy water, was noticing the plates, was feeling their body involved in this activity, they reported far higher levels of satisfaction and well-being than if a person was doing something we might think of as pleasurable, like eating a gourmet meal or making love, but their mind was wandering. Mm-hmm. Their mind was elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So we see that, you know, bringing our mind into the present is not only useful for dealing with painful circumstances and reducing suffering, but it's terribly useful for actually enjoying life, because mm-hmm. life occurs in the present moment.
And that's the key right there. It's enjoying life. That's what we're all really seeking, is how to live a life that brings us a greater sense of, you know, joy. Joy, right. You know. So let me ask you this question. For those of, you know, my listeners tuning in who don't have teachers nearby, how do people learn? How do people start developing these skills of mindfulness. What would you recommend to them?
Well, there are a lot of resources out there, and if you don't mind the shameless commerce of it, I actually wrote a book for this purpose, which is called, you mentioned it before, The Mindfulness Solution, Everyday Practices for Everyday Problems, which walks people through how to establish a practice. And it's usually best to begin by listening to a guided meditation, and actually for that purpose there's a website. There are many of these, but I'll share mine. It's www.mindfulness-solution.com, and on there are, if you click on the download meditations, there's a whole list, maybe about 20 different free meditations that anybody can try listening to, because the easiest way to start is, even if you don't have a live teacher, to have a recorded teacher and to simply follow the instructions. And maybe with your listeners, we can do a few minutes of practice together. But I would very much recommend, as a way to get started, to try listening to some of those and try participating in them. And there are actually many different practices that are more suited to one or another kind of state of mind. And in the Mindfulness Solution book, I try to outline how you might choose different practices to work both with different states of mind, as well as how to use these practices to work with problems like anxiety, with depression, even interpersonal problems like relationship problems in a couple or parenting challenges, and even working with chronic pain and those kinds of disorders. So you would, you know, once you have a little experience with it, you might want to choose practices that are most suited to particular difficulties or particular things that you're struggling with. But most anybody could start by simply listening to one of the broader practices, like a breath meditation, and just following along.
Well, first of all, let me just endorse what you are doing here on your website, which is mindfulness-solution.com. You're actually giving these free recorded meditations that are, short in nature, I'm sure, because I listened to at least one of them. But you have numerous ones here, so people can just explore and have an experience of playing you, guiding them through one of these meditation experiences, which is wonderful. I'm excited about that. I also want to help you shamelessly plug some of your programs, because you're doing a 24-lecture series. Can you talk about that program, Ron?
Yeah, I just completed this. It's with an organization called The Great Courses. Many of your listeners have probably seen their ads. They just advertised the course in The Economist, and they tend to it's an organization that creates college-like courses for people, but not for credit, mostly for people who are interested in learning about a topic. And we just completed a course called Mindfulness, a Research-Based Path to Well-Being. And it's actually the new science of mindfulness. And the course integrates the latest scientific findings about mindfulness practice with how to develop a personal practice yourself and how to use that practice to work with various challenges that come up in life. And so that's a whole series, and it exists both as an audio course and as a video course. And you can get that if anybody would Google, the organization is called The Teaching Company, or The Great Courses is the series of courses. If you Googled either of those phrases, you'd see, and put in mindfulness, you'd see my course as well as other courses that they offer, and that would be a much more comprehensive, a little bit more of a deeper dive for really learning about this.
So there are many ways for anyone listening to really start exploring the world of mindfulness and how to get the benefits of it. And it's so simple, really, isn't it?
Yeah. We could do a few moments of practice right now just to give people a flavor for what it's like to get started.
Well, I have about 60 seconds, so can we do a 60 second?
Okay, we'll do a very brief one.
Very brief.
Just take a moment and just feel your breath. And just let thoughts come and go. and feel what it feels like to breathe. From the beginning of an inhalation to the end of an exhalation and on to the next breath. Ding. That's our meditation bell.
You know, and that, just that 60-second break can profoundly shift your state and just get you back into the present moment. That's why this is so simple. It's like, you know, a pocket meditation course. It's with you.
It doesn't take much. The mind and the brain is very trainable this way. And I particularly want to mention, for those of you who feel like your mind is on the frisky side and, oh, sitting still is hard, that's okay. It does, it's like going to the gym. You know, some days if you go to the gym and do a given workout, it feels really hard. On another day, it feels relatively effortless. It doesn't matter. You're still developing physical fitness either way. So if it feels easier, feels hard, that's not so important. It's a matter of just giving it a try, and you find that, gosh, your mind and your brain will start to shift. It'll start to show up more for the present moment, and that's whether it feels easy or more difficult to do.
Well, that's called discipline. Just do it. Just stay with the process. The benefits are immense. Dr. Ron Siegel, this has been such a pleasure. I really thank you for being with us today. Thank you for the wonderful work and for the great inspiration and teachings that you are offering so many of us. So thank you once again.
Thanks so much for inviting me to share this with folks.
It's been wonderful. And to all my listeners, thank you for joining in. I'm sure you've really enjoyed this experience and conversation as well. So be sure to tune in next week. And I always want to remind you to honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.